Chapter 9. Broken Tooth was another youngster who lived by himself. His mother lived in the caves, but two more children had come after him, and he had been thrust out to shift for himself. We had witnessed the performance during the several preceding days, and it had given us no little glee. Broken Tooth did not want to go, and every time his mother left the cave he sneaked back into it. When she returned and found him there, her rages were delightful. Half the horde made a practice of watching for these moments. First, from within the cave, would come her scolding and shrieking. Then we could hear sounds of the thrashing, and the yelling of Broken Tooth. About this time the two younger children joined in. And finally, like the eruption of a miniature volcano, Broken Tooth would come flying out. At the end of several days his leaving home was accomplished. He wailed his grief, unheeded, from the center of the open space, for at least half an hour, and then came to live with Lop-Ear and me. Our cave was small, but with squeezing there was room for three. I have no recollection of Broken Tooth spending more than one night with us, so the accident must have happened right away. It came in the middle of the day. In the morning we had eaten our fill of the carrots, and then, made heedless by play, we had ventured onto the big trees just beyond. I cannot understand how Lop-Ear got over his habitual caution, but it must have been the play. We were having a great time playing tree tag. And such tag. We leaped 10 or 15 foot gaps as a matter of course. And a 20 or 25 foot deliberate drop clear down to the ground was nothing to us. In fact, I am almost afraid to say the great distances we dropped. As we grew older and heavier, we found we had to be more cautious in dropping, but at that age our bodies were all strings and springs and we could do anything. Broken Tooth displayed remarkable agility in the game. He was T less frequently than any of us, and in the course of the game he discovered one difficult lip that neither Lop-Ear nor I was able to accomplish. To be truthful, we were afraid to attempt it. When we were T, Broken Tooth always ran out to the end of a lofty branch in a certain tree. From the end of the branch to the ground it must have been 70 feet, and nothing intervened to break a fall. But about 20 feet lower down, and fully 15 feet out from the perpendicular, was the thick branch of another tree. As we ran out the limb, Broken Tooth, facing us, would begin teetering. This naturally impeded our progress, but there was more in the teetering than that. He teetered with his back to the jump he was to make. Just as we nearly reached him, he would let go. The teetering branch was like a springboard. It threw him far out, backward, as he fell. And as he fell he turned around sidewise in the air so as to face the other branch into which he was falling. This branch bent far down under the impact, and sometimes there was an ominous crackling, but it never broke, and out of the leaves was always to be seen the face of Broken Tooth grinning triumphantly up at us. I was T the last time Broken Tooth tried this. He had gained the end of the branch, and begun his teetering, and I was creeping out after him, when suddenly there came a low warning cry from Lop-Ear. I looked down, and saw him in the main fork of the tree crouching close against the trunk. Instinctively I crouched down upon the thick limb. Broken Tooth stopped teetering, but the branch would not stop, and his body continued bobbing up and down with the rustling leaves. I heard the crackle of a dry twig, and looking down saw my first fireman. He was creeping stealthily along on the ground, and peering up into the tree. At first I thought he was a wild animal, because he wore around his waist, and over his shoulders a ragged piece of bearskin. And then I saw his hands and feet, and more clearly his features. He was very much like my kind, except that he was less hairy, and that his feet were less like hands than ours. In fact, he and his people, as I was later to know, were far less hairy than we, though we, in turn, were equally less hairy than the tree people. It came to me instantly, as I looked at him. This was the terror of the Northeast, of which the mystery of smoke was a token. Yet I was puzzled. Certainly he was nothing, of which to be afraid. Red Eye or any of our strong men would have been more than a match for him. He was old too, wizened with age, and the hair on his face was gray. Also, he limped badly with one leg. There was no doubt at all that we could outrun him and outclimb him. He could never catch us, that was certain. But he carried something in his hand that I had never seen before. It was a bow and arrow. But at that time a bow and arrow had no meaning for me. How was I to know that death lurked in that bent piece of wood? But Lop-Ear knew. He had evidently seen the Fire People before and knew something of their ways. The fireman peered up at him and circled around the tree. And around the main trunk above the fork Lop-Ear circled too, keeping always the trunk between himself and the fireman. The latter abruptly reversed his circling. Lop-Ear, caught unawares, also hastily reversed, but did not win the protection of the trunk until after the fireman had twanged the bough. I saw the arrow leap up, miss Lop-Ear, glance against a limb, and fall back to the ground. I danced up and down on my lofty perch with delight. It was a game. The fireman was throwing things at Lop-Ear as we sometimes threw things at one another. The game continued a little longer, but Lop-Ear did not expose himself a second time. Then the fireman gave it up. I leaned far out over my horizontal limb and chattered down at him. I wanted to play. I wanted to have him try to hit me with the thing. He saw me, but ignored me, turning his attention to Broken Tooth, who was still teetering slightly and involuntarily on the end of the branch. The first arrow leaped upward. Broken Tooth yelled with fright and pain. It had reached its mark. This put a new complexion on the matter. I no longer cared to play, but crouched trembling close to my limb. A second arrow and a third soared up, missing Broken Tooth, rustling the leaves as they passed through, arching in their flight and returning to earth. The fireman stretched his bow again. He shifted his position, walking away several steps, then shifted it a second time. The bowstring twanged, the arrow leaped upward, and Broken Tooth, uttering a terrible scream, fell off the branch. I saw him as he went down, turning over and over, all arms and legs it seemed, the shaft of the arrow projecting from his chest and appearing and disappearing with each revolution of his body. Sheer down, screaming, 70 feet he fell, smashing to the earth with an audible thud and crunch, his body rebounding slightly and settling down again. Still he lived, for he moved and squirmed, clawing with his hands and feet. I remember the fireman running forward with a stone and hammering him on the head. And then I remember no more. Always, during my childhood, at this stage of the dream, did I wake up screaming with fright to find, often, my mother or nurse, anxious and startled, by my bedside, passing soothing hands through my hair and telling me that they were there and that there was nothing to fear. My next dream, in the order of succession, begins always with the flight of Lop-Ear and myself through the forest. The fireman and Broken Tooth, and the tree of the tragedy are gone. Lop-Ear and I, in a cautious panic, are fleeing through the trees. In my right leg is a burning pain, and from the flesh, protruding head and shaft from either side, is an arrow of the fireman. Not only did the pull and strain of it pain me severely, but it bothered my movements, and made it impossible for me to keep up with Lop-Ear. At last I gave up, crouching in the secure fork of a tree. Lop-Ear went right on. I called to him most plaintively, I remember, and he stopped and looked back. Then he returned to me, climbing into the fork and examining the arrow. He tried to pull it out, but one way the flesh resisted the barbed lead, and the other way it resisted the feathered shaft. Also, it hurt grievously, and I stopped him. For some time we crouched there, Lop-Ear nervous and anxious to be gone, perpetually and apprehensively peering this way and that, and myself whimpering softly and sobbing. Lop-Ear was plainly in a funk, and yet his conduct in remaining by me, in spite of his fear, I take as a foreshadowing of the altruism and comradeship that of help make man the mightiest of the animals. Once again Lop-Ear tried to drag the arrow through the flesh, and I angrily stopped him. Then he bent down, and began gnawing the shaft of the arrow with his teeth. As he did, so he held the arrow firmly in both hands, so that it would not play about in the wound, and at the same time I held on to him. I often meditate upon this scene, the two of us, half-grown cubs, in the childhood of the race, and the one mastering his fear, beating down his selfish impulse of flight, in order to stand by and succor the other. And there rises up before me all that was there foreshadowed, and I see visions of Damon and Pythias, of life-saving crews and Red Cross nurses, of martyrs and leaders of forlorn hopes, of Father Damien, and of the Christ himself, and of all the men of earth, mighty of stature, whose strength may trace back to the elemental loins of Lop-Ear, and Big Tooth and other dim denizens of the younger world. When Lop-Ear had chewed off the head of the arrow, the shaft was withdrawn easily enough. I started to go on, but this time it was he that stopped me. My leg was bleeding profusely. Some of the smaller veins had doubtless been ruptured. Running out to the end of a branch, Lop-Ear gathered a handful of green leaves. These he stuffed into the wound. They accomplished the purpose, for the bleeding soon stopped. Then we went on together, back to the safety of the caves. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.